Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston and PRI, it's Here and Now. I'm Deborah Becker. Coming up, Congress gets set to vote on extending unemployment benefits for millions of workers. If passed, the benefits will run through Election Day. Also, a close look at a major growth industry in the U.S. post-9/11. We'll talk to Bill Arkin of The Washington Post about the paper's series on the massive growth in the intelligence business. Plus, the terrifying sport of super caving and the race to find the deepest place on Earth.
Only in super cave do the explorers not know what the next 10 feet, 10 yards, or half mile will bring.
These stories coming up Here and Now.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Relief may soon be on the way for the 99ers, the approximately 2 million Americans who've been out of work for more than 99 weeks, whose state and federal jobless benefits have run out. Senate Democrats are expected to pass a long-stalled extension of federal unemployment benefits today. It would offer benefits through November to the long-term unemployed. Republicans, who have succeeded in blocking the extension three times so far, say the $33 billion measure adds too much to the deficit and should be offset with spending cuts. Joining us on his cell phone from Capitol Hill is Peter Cook. He's chief Washington correspondent for Bloomberg Television. Hello, Peter.
How are you, Deb?
Okay, well, this is pretty much a political story at this point. Democrats appear to be able to break the logjam on this bill because the new senator from West Virginia is being sworn in just before the vote. What are both parties considering here as this measure comes up for a vote?
Well, I think you're right. There's a lot of politics involved here, and both sides think the politics favor them. Democrats, of course, have been pushing for this extension of unemployment benefits for months now. They faced Republican opposition. They believe at the end of the day that there are a lot of Americans out there who believe that those who are facing long-term unemployment deserve this kind of assistance and that they're going to be seen in this midterm election year as trying to help those folks. Republicans believe that this is a deficit issue, that this extension should be paid for, unlike the previous extensions, and they are digging in their heels, making this a deficit issue, saying they favor the extension, but it should be paid for.
And we know that there are some Republican lawmakers who will cross over with the Democrats and some who will not. Who are the critical votes here?
Well, the two key Republicans who will vote with the Democrats, at least the Democrats certainly are counting on them, are Olympia Snow and Susan Collins, the two main Republicans. They backed this extension in the past, and they've been short. The Democrats have one vote, and as you said, the new West Virginia Senator, Clark Goodwin, he's going to step into the fold immediately and cast a very important vote for Democrats to give them that advantage. There is one Democrat who is likely to vote against this measure. That is Ben Nelson of Nebraska. He has opposed this in the past. So the Democrats losing one of their own, but gaining two Republicans, giving him that crucial 60 votes.
Mm-hmm. And the big question, as you said, is how can the country afford this? How would it be paid for?
Well, it wouldn't be paid for right now, and Democrats have made the argument consistently, and the president did yesterday, as did his spokesman Robert Gibbs, that this has always been treated as emergency funding, that this is something that needs to be done outside of the normal budget process, and that's been the tradition here in Washington. Republicans say in this environment, with this kind of deficit looming in front of the country, that's unacceptable, already given the extensions that we've seen out there. So they are insisting that it be paid for. They have suggested maybe some of the unspent stimulus money should be used to pay for this.
That's been the argument from Massachusetts Senator Scott Brown, to use the stimulus money to help pay for this and not add to the deficit.
That's right. And I heard him on the floor a few weeks ago before the July recess making that case. And Republicans have tried to use that money for a host of other reasons here, and Democrats resisting that so far. And again, sticking to their guns that this kind of spending has been emergency spending. And Republicans are, again, digging in their heels. It may be an emergency situation, but it's got to be paid for.
Now, as we said, this has come up three times so far, this extension. And now this bill, as I understand it today, has been simplified, several provisions taken out of it. What's been dropped, essentially?
Well, again, it has been scaled back to try and win support, not only from Republicans, but from some Democrats who are worried about the price tag as well. They're was a 65% subsidy created last year to help the jobless buy health insurance, the COBRA program, from their former employees. That's been allowed to lapse in this. Also, the size of the checks will be smaller. The Democrats had hoped the benefits would include an extra $25. That's been dropped as well. And they also, those recipients will not be able to exempt a portion of these benefits from their taxes. That also has been something Democrats have been pushing.
Mm-hmm. And this is not a permanent extension to unemployment benefits. Is that right?
That's correct. It would be an extension through November only, and the original plan, Democrats had hoped to extend it through the end of the year, and this will only get them through November, and Robert Gibbs indicated yesterday it's quite likely we'll be back at this fight again.
Hmm. And because, as we said, this is really a political story, and you're saying it may come up again, we've got midterm elections in November, and then there are these studies that suggest that there is really not a definitive way of measuring how unemployment benefits affect the economy. Do they keep people out of the job market, really, and keep the unemployment rate high?
Well, there was a study that we reported on here at Bloomberg by some economists at the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco. Their conclusions were that it's had a relatively modest effect on the unemployment rate. Their conclusions are that the unemployment rate, had these unemployment benefits not been extended, would have dipped to 9.6% at the end of last year from 10%. Again, they refer to that as relatively modest, and that debate has continued both here on Capitol Hill and within economic circles as to whether or not, for any reason, extending these benefits does keep some Americans from actively looking for a new job. The president and Democrats have largely challenged that and questioned that attitude, and the president was joined by some of those people who would qualify for these benefits yesterday at the White House, again, making the point they were actively looking for jobs, but they needed this kind of help now.
So the debate will continue.
That's right.
All right. Peter Cook, Chief Washington Correspondent for Bloomberg Television. Thanks very much for speaking with us.
You bet.
We want to turn now to an area that some critics have called a jobs program, and that's the top-secret national security world created after 9/11. The Washington Post is publishing a series this week titled Top Secret America. It examines the phenomenal growth of national security and intelligence agencies in the past 9 years. It documents overlapping responsibilities, turf battles, and the role of private contractors in top-secret work. The government has already fired back, questioning some of the reporting and asking whether the series could provide sensitive information to would-be terrorists. Bill Arkin is a national security reporter for The Washington Post. He and Dana Priest co-wrote the series, and he joins us from Washington. Welcome to Here and Now, Bill.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Well, before we talk about some of the things that you uncovered in your series, we should say that today, retired Air Force General James Clapper goes before the Senate Intelligence Committee on his nomination to be Director of National Intelligence, and he is likely to face some questions that have been raised by your series. He's actually quoted in it as saying, and I'm paraphrasing here, there's only one entity in the entire universe that has a complete picture of what's going on in the intelligence world, and that's God. Do you think he's going to get some flack for saying that?
Well, I don't know. I would imagine that the administration wouldn't have offered up General Clapper as a potential director of national intelligence unless they thought that he was going to be confirmed. He's already the undersecretary of defense for intelligence. So my sense would be that certainly a larger focus of his confirmation hearings will certainly be the contracting issue and the way in which the intelligence community and the federal government in general has become more dependent upon contractors since 9/11. But my guess is that this is a bigger issue that Congress will have to grapple with way beyond today.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about some of the main issues in your series here. The goal after 9/11 was to streamline intelligence, really, so agencies would share information. But your reporting shows that the number of agencies actually has ballooned. Can you paint a picture of that for us?
Well, in August of 2008, Dana Priest and I were talking about something that we both were seeing that was kind of befuddling us, that somehow there had been a transformation of government since 9/11, that there were new organizations, ad hoc organizations, a building boom in Washington, a lot going on that didn't to us seem to be the normal government, that there was either something above it or something below it. But we started our investigation then 2 years ago to look into what had happened since 9/11 And I can remember very clearly being extremely excited when we found 20 new organizations that had been created since 9/11, and thinking that there were some 200 corporations that did top secret work for the U.S. government. And now we're up to 1,271 organizations in total, 280 of which have been newly established or reformed since 9/11, and 2,000 corporations. And so this is truly a massive infrastructure that has been created, and it's so huge. And it's so fractured in that some of it belongs to the intelligence community and some of it belongs to the Defense Department and some of it belongs to the Department of Homeland Security and some of it belongs to the law enforcement agencies, that there's no one person who has full visibility over it. And at the same time, there really isn't even a sense of whether or not all of those redundancies and all of that ad hocery equals either effective government or better security.
And what about spending on this? How much do you have a ballpark figure, at least? I know it's got to be difficult because we are talking about sensitive information here, but how much are we spending on this operation?
Well, everybody has asked me this question over the last couple of days, and I just want you to know when I give the answer, I don't have a clue. I don't feel bad anymore because they don't either. So one of the things we've learned is that, you know, this is bureaucratic games here. Nobody who's in Agency A really wants Agency B to know what they're spending and who their contractors are. And no company in America has an incentive to cooperate with another company in doing their job. This is a profit motive on the part of corporations, not the way the framers of our Constitution meant for our government to work. And now that we have become so dependent upon these private sector entities, the reality is that it is in itself intrinsically anti-cooperative, anti-connecting the dots, anti-efficient, and that's what we've discovered. That's what the data and the examination over 2 years really points to. Does that mean that these aren't patriotic people? No. Does it mean that these people don't work very hard? No. But it means that we have fundamentally altered the nature of government since 9/11. And now for the first time, I think people can see the big picture of what's been created.
Mm-hmm. That's the focus of today's story in your series, Private Contractors. Mainly, what are they doing?
Well, see, that's the funny thing. You know, if we were talking in 2002 and we had done a series about how the government had to reach out to private industry in order to ramp up after 9/11 and do something much quicker than government itself can do, it wouldn't be so extraordinary. But here we are a decade after 9/11, and of the 850,000 people who have top secret clearances conferred by the United States government, a third of them work for private companies. So they're not just the security guards. They're not just the maintenance people. They're not just the people who work in the cafeterias who have the contract to do so at the CIA. These are people who are analysts, who are translators, who are actually pulling the trigger in Afghanistan and Iraq. These are people who are doing the work that we normally think of as government work, and yet at the same time, they are not public servants who are accountable to the government. They are private individuals who are accountable to their companies, who are accountable to their shareholders, who are trying to make money.
Well, the government has something to say about that, and we'll talk about that after a break. We're speaking with Washington Post national security reporter Bill Arkin. He and Dana Priest co-authored the Post series Top Secret America, about the explosive growth of the national security apparatus. We have links to the Post site, which includes videos and photos, and for more information about their reporting, you can go to our website, hereandnow.org. We'll have more with Bill Arkin coming up. You're listening to Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with Washington Post national security reporter Bill Arkin. He and his colleague Dana Priest co-authored the Post series Top Secret America, which is a two-year investigation into the enormous growth of national security organizations since 9/11. And Bill, right before the break, we were talking about private contractors and the debate over the number of private contractors now at work in national security in the U.S. And the White House has actually issued a response to some of the things in your series, and it says that the number of contractors actually comprise about 28% of the total military intelligence staff workforce. And it also says that it needed some private contractors because there was a unique expertise required post 9/11. What do you say to that?
Well, first of all, that's exactly what we say in our story, so it's certainly not a refutation. We say 30%, they say 28. Oh, well, I'm sorry. So the reality is that what we have discovered in looking at the actual data is that what we think of as the military-industrial complex has also profoundly changed. Of the 2,000 companies that are engaged in top-secret work, only 66 of them are what we would normally think of as the hardware giants of the world of the defense industry, the military-industrial complex. Almost half of those companies are information technology companies. So I don't necessarily disagree with the statement of the DNI that these are companies that are providing expertise that isn't available in government. I'm questioning whether or not we need to have 700-plus companies providing top-secret IT services to the U.S. government. And I'm questioning whether or not all of that money is buying what it is that the American public believes that it's buying, which is better security and national security. Hmm. So I don't think that the Directorate of National Intelligence or the White House disputes anything about the merits of our story. And for them to put out a fact sheet about contracting that merely explains that this is hard work and therefore that's why we have so many contractors doing it really doesn't address the fundamental questions.
But, you know, they can say we haven't had a terrorist attack. And so, does that mean that we are safer and we have been safer because of this?
Well, there's two things that I would say about that. First of all, it's important to recognize that what we're writing about here is not just the intelligence community. It's the entire governmental apparatus which has been created since 9/11. So the Directorate of National Intelligence only speaks for a very small portion of it. Second of all, I think that we asked the government over a long period of time, 2 years, you know, give us some specific examples of the successes of the system. We would love to report on them, and we never heard a response from the government in all of our reporting that was in any way meaningful. And the second thing I would say is, look, we're fighting two wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. We're fighting a war on terrorism globally, and lots of people are dying, and there have been lots of terrorist attacks, even in the United States, even by a member of the U.S. Armed Forces when Major Hassan opened fire at Fort Hood, Texas. And to say then, therefore, that just because there hasn't been another 9/11 to me seems very empty in terms of an interpretation of what has transpired in the last decade.
But drone attacks in Afghanistan have been cited as a positive, certainly a positive way that this new technology and some of the money has been spent, certainly in a way that's helped the U.S.
There's no question that this system has become bigger. That has become more focused, that it has become better at what it does in comparison to September 10th, 2001. But there's also no question that it has become so big that those drones are also collecting an amount of information that the U.S. is just not able to assimilate or process or move quickly enough or effectively enough in order to do its job. Everyone recognizes that the system has become too large and too unwieldy. We have the Secretary of Defense and the Director of the CIA saying it on the record in our stories. So I don't think that the issue is whether or not there hasn't hasn't been a success or whether there hasn't been some change. It's whether or not the system has become so unwieldy and the competition between bureaucracies has become so intense that there's no incentive any longer for there to be a more efficient and effective method.
Are you concerned at all about compiling some of all of this information in one place and whether that just gives access to would-be terrorists to some sensitive information?
Well, I am. I'm an American. I am concerned about that question. And fortunately, I have a lot of editors above me and a lot of lawyers who look at all this stuff, who make those determinations. And I, as the reporter, don't always like the decisions that they make. But we have been engaged in a dialogue with the United States government since March of this year. They've had more than enough time to tell us in that dialogue exactly what it is that they haven't wanted us to publish or what they felt was too sensitive. We weighed everything specifically that they told us, and in fact, any specific suggestion that the government came to us with, I believe our editors made a decision to grant. But the general comments that we got from many people inside government at an official level that they just would prefer that we not do this was not enough for us to really answer. And so we had to rely upon the journalistic credibility and our own judgment to determine whether there was anything that we did that infringed on public safety, and I think we made the right balance.
All right, Washington Post national security reporter Bill Arkin, his series Top Secret America, a two-year investigation into the growth of national security organizations since 9/11, is being published in the Washington Post this week. Bill, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, France has started banning face coverings in public, which has infuriated many Muslim women who say their rights are being violated. Could such a burqa ban happen in the U.S.? That's tomorrow, Here and Now. A domestic workers' bill of rights in New York. It's the first of its kind in the country, mandating overtime and days off, plus long periods of time spent in darkness, dangerous and difficult climbs. Why do people explore the deepest caves on Earth?
You will hear every one of them say, I love the idea of being able to go where no human has ever, ever gone before.
These stories coming up here and now. I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The number of inmates in European prisons is a growing concern for governments across the continent, with prisons filled beyond capacity in Spain, Italy, and the UK. In Britain, the new Conservative government has made cutting the record number of prisoners in England and Wales a priority. The number of inmates per capita there is almost twice the number of prisoners in Northern Ireland. So, what accounts for the difference, and what lessons might Europe take from Northern Ireland? The BBC's Mark Simpson has the story.
Hundreds of prisoners were let out early from Northern Ireland's jails. That was 10 years ago, as part of an early release scheme during the early days of the peace process. It was a significant moment, but it doesn't explain why one decade later, Northern Ireland has a relatively small prison population compared to the rest of the UK and some European countries like Spain and the Czech Republic. The explanation can be found at the Queen's University Law School. Behind the squeakiest door in Belfast, Dr. Graham Ellison has been studying the statistics. The recorded crime rate in Northern Ireland is almost 30% lower than England and Wales.
Northern Ireland doesn't have a significant serious drugs problem, for example, crack cocaine, which is commonplace in many large cities. The second major factor, I think, affecting custodial rates is in relation to young offending and the mandatory nature of the youth conferencing service in Northern Ireland. By law, courts in Northern Ireland have to offer a youth conference as an alternative to a custodial sentence.
But what exactly is youth conferencing? Alice Chapman from the Youth Justice Agency explains.
starts off with a young person. By that I mean somebody under the age of 18 commits a crime and is caught for that crime and admits to it. And they then, from either the prosecutor or the court, they will be referred to us for what's called a youth conference if they've admitted their guilt and if they consent. And that means that they will agree to meet their victim face to face. They then will tell them what they'd like them to do to make amends for it. The law says there are certain things a young person can do, and the victim will have an effect, an influence on this. They can apologise, they can make restitution, they can do community service, they can have electronic tagging, they can do programmes such as things to stop them with alcohol or drugs from that. They can have medical treatment if required. They can be under a curfew. And when all that's finished, we will let the victim know that they've completed all those things that they said they were going to do and they fulfilled all their obligations. And if they don't do it, we can then take them back to court on a breach.
What do you say to people who would argue that this isn't really justice at all? At best, it's justice on the cheap.
The eyeballing, the looking, the conversation between the offender and the victim makes it real. And that is a big thing that makes a difference. It's two people who aren't just statistics and numbers and a whole of a criminal justice system. It makes it real. The reoffending is a bit lower than any other community disposal, and it costs significantly less.
Over a hot cup of tea, I had a brief chat with a teenager who's been through the system after committing a long list of crimes.
Drug offences, have a couple for burglary, a few for assaulting police, stealing cars, loitering.
After admitting stealing the car of an elderly woman, he agreed to meet her. He says watching her cry in front of him changed his life.
All she'd done was cry, and she says she doesn't feel safe in her own home. And when I walked out of that youth conference, I just said to myself, what have I done?
The Northern Ireland justice system is by no means perfect. Some politicians here say it's simply too soft on crime. But at the Department of Justice in Belfast, the Government Minister David Ford says other parts of Europe can learn from Northern Ireland's example.
I think in Northern Ireland our family structures are still more solid than they are across the water, and that's probably a help. But I also think the good work that's done, for example, by the Youth Justice Agency in diverting young people before they become serious criminals is a major part of our success. I suspect what we've probably proven is that care works and incarceration doesn't.
That report from the BBC's Mark Simpson in Belfast. Welcome back. New York recently became the first state to grant some workplace rights to domestic workers. Excluded from the fair labor laws of the 1930s, nannies and elderly caregivers have operated in a kind of gray area with no regulations about overtime or days off and no protections from discrimination or abuse. Domestic Workers United, which represents some of the more than 200,000 caregivers in New York, helped push through the legislation. With us is the director of that group, Priscilla Gonzalez. And Priscilla, why is this law important?
The Domestic Workers Bill of Rights is important for a number of reasons. One, because it recognizes domestic workers as real workers for the first time in the history of this country. The Bill of Rights in New York guarantees basic protections and basic rights that domestic workers have not been able to enjoy for 75 years.
What kinds of rights have domestic workers had thus far? Any?
Up until now, domestic workers have been covered by minimum wage and in some cases overtime, and that's about it. They have no legal recourse when their employers violate their basic human right to be able to live and work with dignity and respect. So the Bill of Rights calls for a day of rest per week, overtime across the board for live-in and live-out workers, and also protection from discrimination. And what's really key about this bill is that it also is going to commission the Department of Labor in New York to conduct a study on the feasibility of collective bargaining in this industry.
I'm just wondering, you had mentioned initially that already domestic workers had some wage protection, some overtime protection, but no legal recourse. It almost sounds really like this bill doesn't give domestic workers much legal recourse either.
No, it actually does. It gives domestic workers the opportunity to seek redress for violations against any of those provisions by going to the Department of Labor and filing a complaint, by being able to sue their employers for violating or not providing any of those provisions, like a day of rest or the overtime. And it also empowers the Attorney General to bring cases on behalf of domestic workers.
Okay, so they do have the right to sue their employer.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's what the significant thing about the Domestic Workers Bill of Rights is, that it gives workers a level of security that they never had before.
Do employers have to give domestic workers 2 weeks notice before they're let go?
Employers should, because it's standard labor practice in many other industries, but it is not a stipulation in the bill, so it's not law.
So what was the main sticking point here in terms of getting this bill passed in New York? What was the provision that was key to enable lawmakers to reach a compromise?
The debate was centered around guaranteeing special rights to one set of workers that isn't afforded to most other workers, or to any worker for that matter. Because what we had originally been pushing, in addition to the provisions I just mentioned, were also sick days, holidays, vacation, and notice of termination or severance pay, which no one gets under the law. But we weren't asking for special rights. Our sector is structured very differently from most other sectors, where workers have either the right or the possibility to bargain or negotiate collectively with their employer. The domestic work industry is totally decentralized, where you have thousands of employers and thousands of workers, and you typically only have one worker in her place of employment. And so there isn't a collective body that's going to bargain with an employer, because there's thousands of employers. And so what we were arguing is that these rights actually need to be legislated, the rights like sick days and holidays and vacation, because any domestic worker that tries to negotiate for those things with her employer on her own literally puts her job on the line. We had one case where a worker was asked to work up to 60 hours. She had been doing roughly 40 and was asked to work up to 60 hours. So when she put on the table, you know, you're going to have to pay me overtime, the employer waved his hand dismissively in her face and said, don't even go there. That's the reality, the day-to-day reality for a domestic worker. If she has to go to the doctors or take care of her sick child, go get a mammogram, I mean, she can't, because she'll either lose a day of pay, even if she's working full-time, or her employer could say, all right, you can go, but you don't have to come back. And that was perfectly and has been totally sanctioned, because the industry has literally functioned underground behind closed doors, and nobody has paid attention to what's been happening to these workers.
You know, a lot of workers, domestic workers, are paid off the books, so to speak, and many employers say that's the way the workers want it. Will this law in New York affect those workers?
Well, it's interesting, because there's actually a lot of workers that are interested in filing taxes, that actually are filing taxes. Many workers understand the importance of paying into Social Security, because it could be a security, you know, it's a safety net for them in the future. And it's actually a lot of employers that don't want to deal with the hassles of filing as an employer and paying taxes and things like that. What the Bill of Rights does, I mean, it doesn't have any stipulation in there around taxes, because that's already in the law. But what it does is that it raises the level of visibility for the workforce, and it also lets employers know that they will be held accountable for violating laws that are already on the books and for violating this law.
One of the concerns that was expressed during the debate in New York was that it could further burden working parents, a group that's that's already struggling during an economic downturn. Are you concerned that this law could lead to less work for domestic caregivers?
The costs are pretty nominal for employers. Really, there is a moral argument to be made here around what is the alternative. The alternative is to continue your lifestyle on the backs of somebody else.
Priscilla Gonzalez, director of the group Domestic Workers United, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much, Deborah.
And later this week on Here and Now, we're going to begin our summer series on local fairs and festivals. And we want to hear from you. Visit us on Facebook at WBUR's Here and Now and tell us what's interesting or unique about your festival. You can also post pictures or videos of your local fair, and we'll be featuring festivals suggested by you on the air throughout the summer. Welcome back. The 1953 ascent to the summit of Mount Everest, the highest point on Earth, is known throughout the world. But what about the descent into the deepest place on Earth? Deep cave exploration combines athleticism, science, competition, and obsession, just like mountain climbing, and yet those who pursue it are not nearly as well known. James Tabor writes about two men who are at the top of those who plumb the depths of the Earth. Their 2004 race to find the deepest place on Earth is explained in his new book titled Blind Descent. And he joins us in the studio to talk about this. Welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm really happy to be here.
Well, I have to say, before I read your book, I didn't know where the deepest place on Earth was or who discovered it. So could you tell us?
The deepest cave on Earth, well, maybe I shouldn't spell out the secret, but I'll tell you the two candidates.
Okay.
One is a great super cave in Mexico called Cheve, southern Mexico, and the other is a great super cave in the Republic of Georgia called Krubera. And in 2004, two great scientist explorers were leading two separate expeditions into those caves, each man thinking his would turn out to be the deepest of all.
Well, let's start with explaining to folks what deep cave exploration or super caving is. What is it?
It's like climbing Mount Everest in reverse. These great expeditions involve scores of participants who are on site for months. They cost hundreds of thousands of dollars. And in the biggest caves, the participants are underground for up to a month. Contrast that to climbers on Everest who are really on technical terrain, say, for 7 to 10 days maximum.
Mm-hmm. And can you describe actually what it's like to go through these depths and really what's encountered most of the time by the folks who supercave?
Sure. There are many, many challenges involved in supercaving that are not found in any other form of exploration. I'll tell you, the most noticeable one is that you do it in absolute eternal darkness. Now, it's true that cavers have lights, but unless you are moving or performing a task, you turn your light off. So you spend the bulk of your time in that kind of darkness. The eyes never adjust to it. They're always relaying back false light images to you. And some people will eventually start hallucinating from that kind of activity. People have reported seeing skulls floating around and demon faces and all kinds of bizarre, deranging things. The other thing that most people might not realize is that supercaving is tremendously vertical. There are huge vertical drops in all supercaves, Cheve and Kruber and all the others, which have to be rappelled using specialized heavy-duty equipment. And then there are also flooded tunnels that they're called sumps. Some of them are short enough that you can hold your breath and dive through quickly, like 5 to 8 feet, but many are huge and require very sophisticated scuba diving equipment to get through. It's the most dangerous, absolutely the most dangerous form of scuba diving on Earth, and all things considered, I think the most dangerous form of exploration. There's absolutely no margin for error, and if anything goes wrong, well, you're just going to stay there.
There's no rescue team.
Well, that's where I was going to go next. You can be rescued now. The French put a helicopter on top of Mount Everest in 2005. So essentially, you can be rescued from any mountain on Earth. We have submersibles that can rescue trapped mariners thousands of feet deep. There's no rescue from a supercave when you're deep down in there. For one thing, there's no communication with the surface. So if you're 5 miles in and 6,000 feet down and you get in trouble, you solve the problem on your own or you don't. You know, even Apollo 13 had radio contact with Mission Control, which helped them save themselves. Not so in a super cave. The experienced cavers have a saying, if you get hurt down there, chances are good you're not coming out. Mm-hmm. And then the final thing is, Only in super caves do the explorers not know what the next 10 feet, 10 yards, or half mile will bring. Every other form of exploration involves previewing with images or maps, whether you're talking about space flight, oceaneering, mountaineering. There's no way to get those previews in a cave. The only way to do it is to put human feet in the cave and eyes in the passage.
Is that part of the draw?
For the people who are serious super cavers, I think absolutely it's part of the draw. Mm. You will hear every one of them say, I love the idea of being able to go where no human has ever, ever gone before. Tremendously adrenalizing for them, I think.
And how big is the super caver community, would you say? Is it?
It's smaller even than the community of extreme mountaineers, if you will, because there are so many skill sets required. You have to be an extraordinarily experienced and proficient diver. You have to be a climber. You have to be able to ascend on these very complicated ascent rigs. I'm sure there are fewer than 100, and there are probably fewer than 50 really qualified super cavers on Earth.
Well, we won't give it away. We absolutely will not give it away who found the deepest place and where it is. But say we've got Bill Stone on the American team. He's a little bit prickly. He's alpha male. Mm. And then you've got the Ukrainian team. Describe that.
As different as night and day. You know, Bill Stone, first of all, is a huge guy. He's 6'4", 200 pounds. He's solid as a rock. He is an alpha male, as you said, and an impatient type A. And then over on the other side of the world, you've got Alexander Klimchuk. His cavers call him Father Klim because he's so kindly and so avuncular. He's a little guy. He's 5'8", weighs maybe 145 pounds. And his approach to exploration and science is to build great multi-talented teams. Now, he has certainly led his share of expeditions, but he's not reluctant to delegate that to trusted younger cavers. Bill Stone is like a Civil War general. He's always in front, always, and he's doing the hardest, most dangerous, most risky things, but he's always in front. Mm. So they're very, very different.
Hmm. And what about the two caves that they're both focused on in your book? Those are very different as well.
They are indeed. If you can visualize a giant L, that's Cheve. The vertical shaft is about 3,000 vertical feet deep and requires...
And this is Bill Stone's cave.
This is Bill Stone's cave, mm-hmm. Yeah. Requires passage through about 2.5 miles of passageways and various things to get to the bottom of that. And then there's a long, more gradually descending sort of semi-horizontal foot to the L, goes another 2.5 miles and drops another roughly 2,000 vertical feet. It's not a terribly cold cave, 64 degrees, air temperature, give or take, and mid-60s in water. Then you go over to Kruger, and you look at its profile, and it looks like an immense elevator shaft. It's very, very deep. Deep enough that you could put, let's say, as many as 7 Empire State Buildings in it. But 90% of its terrain is vertical and technical. In other words, you're on rope going down or coming up 90% of the time. It's freezing in Krubera. The water temperature is always 32 degrees Fahrenheit because it's coming off a glacial melt. And the air temperature is 34 degrees in summer and 0 degrees in winter, which actually is when they prefer to climb in the winter because there's less chance of flash floods.
Huh. I bet the American team and the Ukrainian team debate which cave is rougher to deal with and which one has more challenges.
They absolutely do. You know, Bill Stone will tell you that there's more pools and water and water hazards in his cave, and Alexander will tell you that his cave is steeper and colder. And in fact, I've talked to two people who were in both caves, and there aren't very many who have done that. And they both said, you know what, they're both dangerous as heck. They'll kill you if your attention wanders for a second. One's a little warmer, one's a little colder. But you know what, they're still just like K2s of caves.
Hmm. So do you think maybe right now we have a deepest point on Earth that you outline in your book that we won't give away, but there's quite possibly somewhere where it's deeper?
I think we have found it, and I'll tell you why. There are very few places on Earth where the geologic conditions exist for the formation of super caves.
Okay, well, we'll see, I guess, won't we?
Yeah.
James Tabor is author of the book Blind Descent, The Quest to Discover the Deepest Place on Earth. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
To read an excerpt of the book and see photos of a super cave, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Deborah Becker. Please join us again, Here and Now. Thank you.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.